Hey, everybody. It is Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. We welcome you to episode number 92 of Tone the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn. We talk pitching each and every week with the five-time World Series champ, the former Cy Young Award winner David Cohn, the research master James Smythe, and myself, Justin Shackle, our wonderful standout producer Dan Rourke with us as well. And we are reacting to some of the biggest pitching names in the game being in the news this week, but we're also going to be talking with Tanner Swanson. He is the quality control and catching coach for the New York Yankees, and we're going to be speaking to Tanner about the catching game intertwining with pitching throughout the majors. So even if you are not a Yankee fan, there is definitely something that you're going to be able to take away from Tanner's spot here with us, and just how big of a focal point receiving has become at the catching position. David, how appreciative do you think our pitchers toward all of this?
I think they have to be very appreciative, and the catchers themselves too. We've heard Jose Trevino, when he was on our podcast, talk about, boy, I wish some of these old school catchers could come and just watch us work and see what we're really doing behind the scenes. And that's a direct result of Tanner Swanson and his input and influence on the catchers. So yes, I think there's much more emphasis on stealing strikes, framing that the Yankees do exceptionally well, and all the other nuances that are continuing to change and evolve. Catchers blocking, for one thing, is a big hot button. Blocking and throwing are two things that old school catchers still knock about the style of today's catchers. The grounded knee, as Tanner calls it. But he goes into detail. I mean, you could get the sense from Tanner that he could talk all day long about this stuff. He kind of started to. We had to cut him off a couple times, right? Because he can really kind of go into depth and give you as much as you want. He's a really smart guy, really hard worker, and a guy that can back up his theories with numbers now. We have a pretty large sample size of data that kind of proves what he's doing is paying dividends.
It was an informative spot with Tanner. We're going to get to that interview in a few moments. We're also going to have a quick Yankee chat near the end, but a couple of items to tackle here before we get to our chat with Tanner Swanson. And one does have to deal with Aaron Judge. I mean, arguably, in the eyes of some, the best player in Major League Baseball. He's going on the injury list for a second time here in 2023. He has a sprained ligament in his right big toe, stemming from the catch that he made at Dodger Stadium where the bullpen door flew open, but there's a slab on the base of the wall, no pun intended there. Concrete, you nubbed your toe, probably, think about stubbing your toe in the middle of the night on your bedpost and then multiply it by a million. I'm sure that's what Aaron Judge is going through here. But as we start with the opener, David, Judge going on the injury list a second time. We see the impact when Judge is out, what it does to this Yankees team. Guys, what do you make of Judge being out, but more importantly, how the Yankees navigate without Aaron Judge?
Wow, you start to look at the AAA roster again, right? If he goes on the IL, you're an outfielder short. How do they mix and match? When is Harrison Bader due back from the IL as well? How close is he? To me, that's the number one question. But maybe, do we see Franchy Cordero again? Is there going to be a return of Esteban Florial potentially? There's some roster maneuvers that would have to be done for that. A lot of people look at a strikeout rate. Florial's, is that going to be something that's a concern for the Yankees? It has been up to this point. So, yeah, I mean, it's all hands on deck. All the depth pieces are being looked at everywhere, including outside the organization. It's almost impossible to make a trade nowadays of any substance because the draft's coming up and trade deadline still has some time to go before we get there. So, yeah, it is a difficult situation right now. To me, first and foremost, run prevention comes to mind. Pitch better. Allow fewer runs, because without Aaron Judge, you're going to score fewer runs.
And the pitching has been better. The bullpen is still the best in the game. You're getting some reinforcements. Giancarlo Stanton is back. Josh Donaldson is back and has looked pretty good. So, many hands make light work. It's not going to be one guy that takes on all of Aaron Judge's production, but if everyone else chips in, you can help there. And the production, as you would guess, with and without Judge, a huge difference, as you might guess. They were playing better than 600 ball with Judge this year, and without him, starting including the first game without him in this White Sox series, they are 6-7 compared to 30-19. The runs per game goes down from about 5 runs a game to a little under 3.5 The average is lower. The slugging is lower. The homers per game is lower. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that Aaron Judge missing from the Yankees lineup is going to be a big absence. But at the same time, it is baseball. There's only so much impact one player can have.
Yeah, when he went on the injury list with the hip injury near the end of April, the offense was already struggling. I mean, they were missing a ton of players, but that kind of just accentuated where the offense was at. And I had multiple Yankees tell me that when Judge was out in the immediate aftermath, you know, the first 5 to 7 games, a lot of players were trying to do too much, maybe more than they were capable of. So just keep that in mind. I think that's an important message, even for the Stantons, the Donaldsons, who are, you know, are just coming back. They're fresh. Certainly Anthony Rizzo, stay within yourself, stay within your abilities, and don't try and make up for what you're losing with Judge in that regard. I think it's a collective effort 1 through 9. And I kind of equate it to maybe like an NBA rotation, you know, losing that key piece in the immediate aftermath. You see like the loss immediately. It takes a good, 7 to 10 games in the NBA for that specific group of players to come together, gel, see what works, find out what fits, and then they kind of hit the ground running again in the aftermath of whatever happens. Maybe it's a trade or a player leaving, player going down. Here with Judge being out, I think the main message here is, because we've already seen it now this season, do not try and do more than what you're capable of. You're not trying to lift a mountain here. Stay within yourself, and I think if the lineup collectively comes together and raises its game, it's better than just that one person looking at it as a burden on their own shoulders. So going to be an interesting couple of weeks. Don't know exactly what the timetable is like for Judge. It's obviously something we're going to be keeping our eye on here as we approach, we're 62 games down, nearing the midway point already here in the baseball season. So Judge hitting the injury list for a second time, not good for the Yankees. We'll see how they navigate this. Jacob DeGrom was on the injured list for the better portion of a month and change. And on Tuesday, we learned that DeGrom will be undergoing a second Tommy John surgery. So his season's over. He'll likely be missing a decent chunk of next season as well as he recovers from Tommy John. The talent with DeGrom is transcendent. We've discussed this countless times here. We've also watched him while kind of holding our breaths the last few seasons because of the injury history. My main question here, in the wake of this news, guys, will we ever see peak Jacob DeGrom again?
Well, he's such a freakishly good athlete. I would say the chances are probably yes, although this is his second Tommy John surgery. The warranty ran out on the first one, 2010. So that goes to show you that you think, oh, let me get Tommy John surgery, I'm risk-free the rest of my career. That's not the case at all. There's been several pitchers over the last 5 to 10 years that have had another Tommy John surgery after having the first one. So I think next postseason, if he could shoot for that, for the Rangers, who seem to be on the upswing, it's hugely disappointing, obviously. But yes, I think he can still make it back. He has such excellent control. He's a three-pitch pitcher. I know we tend to think of Jacob DeGrom as such the power guy, the guy who throws 100 miles an hour, the guy that throws so hard, can his body hold up? But he also has exquisite control, too. He paints that outside corner to righties and inside to lefties so well. He's got an outstanding slider and a changeup to go with it. So projecting in the future for me, just in my own sort of educated guess, kind of a way of going about it, I would say yes. I think he will come back because he is a really good pitcher to go with that power arsenal that he's so known for. And generally speaking, if there was a power guy that just relied solely on power, you might question that, Jack. You might say, I don't know, maybe he's going to suffer a little power. He doesn't really have the finesse to go with it. Jacob DeGrom has always been the best combination of power and finesse in terms of his command. So my answer is yes, I think we will. For the Rangers' sake, maybe next postseason, he comes back and gives them a big boost in August or September down the stretch for them next year.
I think we do, but the depressing thing to think about is that if he does come back and he looks great, how long until the next injury? So will we? I think we will see that kind of pitcher again, but maybe it is just for spurts of 6 or 8 starts at a time. It's a shame, but pitching is very bad for your health.
as has been well documented here on Tone of the Slab. I think we do. I think seeing what Justin Verlander has done the last couple of years gives me hope, because you could put DeGrom in the same category as Verlander in terms of raw talent and stuff. So even though he's in his mid-30s right now, I think there's room for a talent like DeGrom to come back in his late 30s and pitch to that high level. So I'm holding out hope for that. And we definitely wish Jacob DeGrom our best year from a team aspect with the Rangers. And we take a look at this year only. Does Texas have enough pitching now to be a title contender this season? I can't believe I'm even saying that. Like, you know, instead of deep playoff run, you know, a playoff contender. No, the way that the Rangers are performing here this season, we can automatically put them into that group. Are they a title contender, and do they have enough to carry them to a potential World Series appearance?
Nathan Eovaldi is probably the best offseason signing of any starting pitcher at or near the top. I would take him just about over anybody the way he's performed, in terms of not only the way he's performed, but the depth he gives. You know, he's a threat to get really deep into the games in 7-8. He's actually thrown a shutout, pitched 9 innings a couple of times. So, yeah, Dane Dunning's been a surprise for them. Kind of maybe not a surprise if you're there and you've seen him work out of the bullpen and the rotation. He's been really good. Martin Perez, when he gets it going, is one of the best ground ball pitchers, you know, going in the game today. Always at the top or near the top in terms of ground ball double plays and deuce. So, yeah, John Gray, another guy that's really underrated, undervalued, a veteran guy from Colorado, seems to really enjoy pitching in Texas. So, yeah, my answer is yes, that they've made a lot of good bets down there. Chris Young probably should be in consideration for the general manager of the year. Sometimes it's luck. With general managers, you make bets on free agents, on trades. They have made a lot of really good bets down there, including their middle infielders, and Semien and Seager. I mean, wow. You know, just everywhere they turn, other than DeGrom so far, has been a hit. They have won the bets they've made. So you got to give credit where credit's due, and that's right to the top. Ownership, allowing the resources to be used, and Chris Young, one of the best young executives in the game. He deserves a lot of credit.
Last year was the year to shore up the lineup, and adding Seager and Semien is about as good as it gets. And this year was when they needed to shore up the pitching staff. And the thing, when we were talking about these guys as a possible sleeper team during the offseason, it was the change to the pitching staff. Every game you were throwing out a representative big league pitcher, which is not something you could have said about this team for a long time. So even going into the year, DeGrom, Eovaldi, Perez, Gray, Heaney, that's a good solid five. Even with DeGrom out now, Dane Dunning has stepped in. And you talk about a ground ball pitcher, Coney. He's been fantastic. And Perez and Heaney have been, you know, more solid, average to above average starters. Eovaldi's been one of the best pickups in the game. And Gray's been fantastic. So I think that they do have enough pitching. I'm sure they will be very active come the deadline, but a couple things they have in their favor. One, a ridiculously good offense, so they're going to have more margin for error built in anyway, and wins in the bank. They're 40-20. And you say, well, you can, they're not running away with the division, but one thing they do have in their corner is these wins in the bank. If they go 500 the rest of the season, that's 91-71, which would almost certainly get you into the postseason, but they look like that they're going to be well over 500 for the foreseeable future. So good for the Rangers to turn this thing around.
Yeah, I think Texas had the proactive mindset the last two off seasons in terms of building itself into a quick contender. I think they're going to continue to have that mindset in terms of shopping for pitching. They're not going to be afraid to swing a deal here as trade season heats up. And a lot of the players that they, you know, hedge their bets on, it's largely panned out so far at their 20 games over 500. It just, you know, really stinks that the one that didn't at this point is obviously the most talented pitcher in the game when he's healthy and on the mound. 5 years for DeGrom, $185 million as a 34, 35-year-old. I know that raised some eyebrows, even though for Jacob DeGrom, in the end, they're going to have him for about 3.5 seasons if all goes to plan after his Tommy John surgery. People, this summer, HelloFresh is here to take the work out of eating well. Reach your goals with delicious calorie smart and protein smart lunch and dinner options, plus new vegan recipes as well. It is all about portion control if you want that nice summer body, but you don't have to make yourself a prisoner of your own kitchen. You can continue to eat delicious food in a smart way. HelloFresh is one of the big reasons why you're able to do that. Their seasonal ingredients are picked at peak ripeness. They travel from the farm right to your doorstep in less than 7 days for that fresh flavor in every single bite. And the variety is just second to none. HelloFresh delivers mouthwatering, chef-crafted recipes and fresh ingredients to your door so you can spend less time meal planning and prepping here. For me, cooking is very therapeutic, but this cuts out a lot of the steps, saves me a bunch of time when I'm really needing to get on the go there and get to the ballpark. So I can cut the steps out. The kit is ready to roll. And I have a fresh, awesome meal that is healthy in less than an hour of actual prep time. Here's the way that you can get in on the action. Go to HelloFresh.com/slab16 and use code SLAB16 for 16 free meals plus free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/slab16, SLAB16, and start using America's number one meal kit today. The Blue Jays are dealing with some pitching depth issues on top of arguably their most talented starter really struggling here in 2023. And it got to the point where Toronto announced that they had to option Alek Manoah to the Florida Complex League on Tuesday. Manoah's 1-7 this season with an ERA of 6.36 in 13 starts. So nearly half the amount of starts that a pitcher typically averages in a given season. Manoah was really supposed to lead this rotation as he's finished third in Cy Young voting last year. It's kind of been the complete opposite. So what is next for Alek Manoah, guys?
Well, I think it's the right move. Rather than send him down to AAA or AA or whatever and try to put him in a rotation to continue to pitch as part of a regular spot, push the reboot button, send him to the Florida Complex and have a complete evaluation, biomechanically speaking. And that's probably the best place to do it. Most spring training sites now have all the equipment, all the tools, all the toys to be able to do this kind of analysis. And that's really what he needs. He needs one-on-one sort of a look. His organizational pitching coaches, he can have all the resources he needs to kind of rebuild everything. And that's what needs to be looked at here is, if you break down his mechanics, there's something different going on there. His slider has lost almost 3 inches of horizontal movement on it. The quality of the pitch has really gone downhill. That's his signature pitch. The release point looks like it's a little bit off in terms of biomechanics. And when you measure the release point, according to Baseball Savant, these organizations have much more information than we have publicly speaking. So that's what he needs. He needs to get sort of in the garage and have a complete overhaul, a complete look at biomechanically what he's doing. Is there some weakness there? Does he need some strength training? Is part of these mechanical issues because he's a little bit broken down or a little bit fatigued in his shoulder area? That's what needs to be looked at top to bottom, conditioning, overall health, and then a breakdown of his mechanics and how to get him back. And the way to do that is in the Florida Complex, one-on-one instruction, no stress, no eyeballs on him, just kind of put him in the garage, close the garage door, and go to work.
The Blue Jays hope that this is a new age, modern version of Roy Halladay, right? Where he was about as bad as any pitcher had been ever. And back to the drawing board, working with Mel Queen at the time, and he comes back as a Hall of Famer. Now, that's a very pat, tidy little story that a little fairy tale that you can tell pitchers, but it's going to take a lot of work. But Dunedin is the place to be, whether it's Dunedin with the Blue Jays, Tampa with the Yankees, most of these teams now have very advanced, the garage, as you would say, as you called it, Coney. Get in there, full diagnostic, tear down, build back up. It's the place for him to be. It's going to be a long process.
And as for the Blue Jays team operating without Alek Manoah, many said, well, who do they have in his place? The depth has always been a question with Toronto on each side of the ball, but mainly with their pitching staff. Well, you really can't do much worse than what Manoah had been giving you over those 13 starts. So it's obviously something that is, you know, the cost benefit of just getting Manoah away from the team, get him into the garage, lock that puppy up. Hopefully he can figure it out, get back to Toronto and provide what was expected of him at some point here in 2023. All right, let's get to our chat with Tanner Swanson here. He joined the Yankees near the end of 2019, came over from the Twins, but his story is pretty cool. I mean, this was a health education teacher in high school back in Washington State before he advanced to the pro ball coaching ranks. And some of his philosophies have kind of spread a little bit here in Major League Baseball. So we touch in on that. We touch about the new rules. We also get into some good stories with him and his father's bar in Seattle in the old days near the Kingdoms. Tanner's, you know, a resident of Washington State, the Seattle area. So a lot to tackle with the Yankees quality control and catching coach. Tanner Swanson is our guest this week on Tone the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn. Tanner, thanks so much for joining us, and we appreciate the scenic view that you've provided us of the Upper East Side and the Harlem River here. We have 2 months now of data with the new rules in effect across Major League Baseball. What have you and the staff learned with how they are affecting catchers and how they're working with pitchers here?
I think probably the first thing that stands out is just how efficient our guys need to be with from a decision-making process, right? The window between pitches has been condensed. And I think maybe for the better, right? Aside from just the shortening games and so forth. But I think previously there was a lot of time to mull over decisions and maybe overanalyze, you know, which pitch we needed to go with in a particular matchup. So, I think that process has had to really become more efficient. We've done a lot of work behind the scenes to try to streamline that content and simplify, like we talked about a little bit before we started the call here. But I think that has probably stood out the most in terms of, you know, giving guys the information they need to be able to make quick decisions, pitch to pitch. Learning just kind of the game tempo, right? There's a new rhythm to the game that I think there was an adjustment period that took some time to figure out how to not necessarily manipulate the rules, but find ways to give guys a blow if they need to, when we need to make a big pitch, how we can stall or delay and just kind of some of the nuance within the rules to try to, you know, in certain situations, you know, give our pitcher the best opportunity to be able to execute a pitch and maybe get us through an inning. So those things stand out. Obviously the running game has been impacted with the new rules and there's certainly an emphasis or an advantage to the runner. So that's been something that we've had to attempt to combat and with various picks and holds and, maybe new strategies in terms of where we're trying to target throws, just to try to mitigate kind of the inevitable advantage that is kind of shifted towards the runner.
Now, you mentioned the targeting of the throws, and we're seeing that across the league, I think, something that Susan Waldman and I were talking about on the radio broadcast. Every throw feels like it's targeted just to the right of second base. And it's a big reason, I think, why you're seeing a lot of throws from catchers sail into center field. So why does that position work so well? What is that telling you guys?
Yeah, good observation on your guys' part. I mean, it's certainly intentional. You know, like everything else, we have kind of data to kind of support or learn more about kind of where outs are actually being recorded. And they're, in most cases, not directly over the base, which is a little counterintuitive. You know, now with the distance being with the larger bases, the distances between bases is shorter, right? And so trying to kind of cut down the amount of time the ball is actually in the air, you know, the further to the right that throw is the shorter the distance, right? It arrives to the middle infielder sooner. We can only do so much to try to increase arm strength. You know, our catcher's arms at this point kind of are what they are. We've probably chewed off all the meat on the bone in terms of being as quick as possible to, you know, getting the ball out of our hands. So the only other area that we've targeted in terms of trying to make up some ground is, you know, can we cut down the throw time? How can we get the ball there to second base faster? And so targeting slightly up the line, like you mentioned, is something I don't think we're the only organization that's on that trail. I think you're seeing that kind of throughout the league, that a lot of throws are being targeted just to the right of second base. And I think the other thing that it does that's really valuable is it's reducing the tag time, right? The amount of time it takes for the middle infielder to actually catch the ball and then apply the tag. You know, now with instant replay, you know, back in the day, if the ball beat the runner, you know, he was usually ruled out, and that's simply not the case anymore. You physically have to apply a tag. So it doesn't matter if we're tagging the hands, the shoulder, the back, the feet, the helmet, as long as the tag is happening before contact with the base, we'll record an out with replay. So with all that said, I think it's, yes, you're right. There's a little bit more risk in terms of balls getting away from the infielders. But it is a skill that, you know, that we practice. It's something that our middle infielders are aware of. You know, they're encouraging our catchers to deliver the ball there for all the reasons I described. So it's a collective effort. But it does come with more risk. I mean, we could deliver the quote unquote perfect throw chest high at the base, but if the runner's safe, it may look aesthetically pleasing on TV, but we're searching for outs and trying to find any edge we can to win on the margin. So this is certainly one of those.
You know, Tanner, I think that to me, I think your story personally, and I'd like just to give you a chance to give you a little bit of your background, but I know you, you kind of jumped into the Minnesota Twins organization out of Santa Clara, and, you know, you're a trailblazer. I mean, I'm sure you've met a lot of resistance from the old schoolers. You can't catch on one knee guys, and all the innovative stuff you brought to the Yankees and really to the Twins with the work you did there. How did you get to where you are? How did you bust through and become sort of this innovator and this new school style of catching that has really taken hold now, and is really, I mean, it's not new school anymore, right? I mean, you see catchers all across both leagues now catching on one knee and using everything that you brought to the Yankees. How did you come across this? How did you develop, and how did you get your break with the Twins initially?
It certainly wasn't calculated. You know, I had no ambitions of coaching in the big leagues. I never thought that was a possibility. You know, previously, if you didn't play at that level, it was really hard to establish a career as a coach. So I kind of had my head set on college baseball. I was happy. I spent, 4 or 5 years at the University of Washington and then a short stint at Santa Clara. And I wasn't a catcher. I was a mediocre college player, Division II infielder. But when I started coaching at the University of Washington, I got tasked with coaching the catchers, which I had very little experience. And so I think I got to look at it from maybe a different perspective. I got to maybe ask questions that other people weren't asking, maybe dumb questions on the surface, but I didn't carry a lot of bias in terms of, this is how I used to do it. This is what my coaches taught me. So I kind of start with a clean slate and just became obsessed with trying to figure out the details of the position. You know, what were the problems? What are things maybe the industry's missing? And just kind of went on this journey, and not to, by no means to be kind of the contrarian and to fight upstream to try to change the system or how catchers were doing things. But, professional baseball really opened my eyes to, now I had access to all this data and information, and I could look at it really objectively. And, just kind of identified a problem, I think, you know, that stemmed around the stances and positions that catchers were in, and which was, you know, we knew that framing was really important. This is 5 to 10 years ago. That was no secret. It was becoming prominent. Organizations were really trying to optimize it, and whether that was through acquisition or development, whatever, we knew that there was value in being able to add strikes. So when I started digging into the data, it really started with, okay, what are catchers? Let's look at what their skill level is in this regard, with the absence of blocking and throwing. So it started by looking at, this is empty, less than two strikes. There's no other influence that catchers have to worry about, and I kind of use that as the baseline to identify, okay, this is their true talent. And then compared that to, what their receiving metrics looked like, when you added the influence of blocking or throwing. So we add a base runner, what does it look like in two strike counts? And across the league, universally catchers regress. Their receiving metrics almost, league wide, everybody got worse. And so that was interesting to me. And that just led to more questions. And the biggest difference amongst those two base states is the positions that catchers would get into, right? They'd be in this deep, relaxed squat with the bases empty. And now we need to block or throw, and they're in a completely different position. And so that was kind of the first kind of aha moment that said, well, if receiving is so important, this skill is so valuable, and catchers are so much better, in this relaxed deep squat, why aren't we in this position exclusively, right? Why are we in this alternative position, ready to block, ready to throw, when still in those base states, those outcomes are still pretty rare, right? You're in this secondary stance for 50% of the game, and you might block three or four balls and still receive, 50 to 60 and maybe make one throw throughout the course of a game. So the economy in terms of how catchers were using stances interests me. And then that just led to a lot of experimentation in the minor leagues, which I think, the lower level of minor leagues is great for being able to try new things. I was in an organization that really encouraged that kind of trial and error process. And so we just started playing around with different positions, and a lot of this was, this wasn't new necessarily. There were catchers in the 70s and 80s and throughout who would, I think, intuitively get in these knee down positions. And I wouldn't say just because they were maybe more comfortable, but I think intuitively it helped them, catch the ball near the bottom of the strike zone.
Tony Pena, Benito Santiago. Yeah,
exactly. These guys were doing this previously, and for some reason, it got kind of ostracized and it went away, and you saw fewer and fewer catchers utilizing those stances. And given those were only, in those bases empty, less than two strike base states. So we started measuring, we started playing around with those same setups. And I had a baseline from the year previous, when I first got to Minnesota, no catchers were in our organization were utilizing those stances. So we had kind of baseline metrics on what they were previously. And then we put them all in knee down stances, different variations. And we saw progress, almost across every catcher better. And that was, again, just with nobody on base. And so it became pretty clear quickly that these positions were more advantageous. And then the next question was, well, can we learn to block and throw from these positions? And that was kind of the next step is to, and everybody surrounding me was, told me at the time that it wasn't possible. And, the question I asked myself was, well, has anybody really, really given this a shot? Has anybody really tried? And so we did. And not only did we learn that you could block and throw from these positions, that we learned that maybe they were actually better blocking positions. And I think now over time, the data is kind of shaken out. And I can't say that I knew that going into it. I actually kind of was in the belief that, hey, if the receiving gets exponentially better, but the blocking and throwing takes a slight hit, that still might be a net win in terms of run prevention. bench, and that was kind of my mindset going into it. But you know, quickly that shifted, and we once I started seeing catchers block from these positions, and we started playing around with nuance to be able to actually move more efficiently and still while prioritizing the receiving component. You know, it's I think now it's becoming difficult to dispute as the almost the entire league now has kind of adopted this style. So I think there was a little bit of luck involved, a little bit of timing in terms of professional baseball being ready to kind of welcome somebody like myself who didn't have that extensive playing background. And then being in an organization that kind of encouraged that kind of exploration and trial and error. And I think it was kind of the merge of those two things coming together and a little bit of luck along the way.
Yeah, what the biggest...
Go ahead, James. Yeah.
No, I was saying, I just think the biggest misconception around this is the idea that, well, if you do go down on one knee or any of these newer methods, that it hurts you in all these other ways. But as we've seen, if you pool catchers who are traditional stance, catchers who are one knee down stance, and you compare the groups, blocking metrics, framing metrics, throwing numbers, that it isn't a big detriment to the rest of your game, but you can still help yourself in the receiving end. So I think that that's one way that teams have embraced this, because contrary to popular opinion, it doesn't kill you. It doesn't prevent you from blocking a ball in the dirt either.
No, it's again, against conventional wisdom, it actually helps you. And I think you're right. That is the biggest misconception. If the net outcome wasn't, you know, more runs prevented, then teams wouldn't and organizations wouldn't be scaling this method, you know, across their entire systems, and certainly wouldn't be letting guys do this at the major league level, where we know how much money's at stake. So it's not solely about stealing strikes, and the blocking piece, you know, there's this year, and if you include last year, I think we're on pace to, you know, there's fewer wild pitches and pass balls per pitch thrown in our game currently 2023 and 2022 than any other year on record. I mean, so the notion that catchers are chasing balls to the backstop left and right because their knee is grounded it's just not accurate. You know, catchers are preventing 90 feet maybe at a better rate than we ever have across the entire industry. And some of that you could argue maybe is pitch calm. There's fewer cross-ups. It's certainly not solely related to the new setups, but I think it's inaccurate to say that, you know, we're doing a poor job as an industry, you know, securing the baseball and preventing runner advancement. I think catchers across the industry are doing as good a job as we ever have. So I think you're right. There's a lot of misconception around what's really taking place.
Yeah, well, you know, some of the techniques, you know, that we've seen, and I think as a direct result of, you know, what you're teaching as well, is, you know, to block from the grounded position, from your knee grounded. I mean, I'm seeing more hand work, right? Some guys on the short hops. I mean, it's so hard to predict, especially on those short hops, to kind of throw your body and try to get into a block position as opposed to using those great hands, right? I've seen some picks on short hops that seem to be very effective as well. Is that something that you've zeroed in terms of technique, or?
It's something that we practice. I think a couple of things I think at play here were, you know, the receiving has become so prevalent, right? That catchers who don't possess this skill anymore, unless they can really, really hit, you know, you're just seeing fewer and fewer catchers who lack this ability. So naturally they're, you know, catchers are moving through systems and being promoted to the big leagues or acquired because they have really good hands, they have good glove skill. We're just more aware of the value that catchers bring from a receiving standpoint. So there's been a greater emphasis on acquiring those types of players, training, you know, that particular skill. And then letting them utilize those good hands, that elite glove skill. You know, we have more motor control over our hands than any other part of our body. And I think for a long time, it was taboo to to let catchers use those hands to block. It was you had to get your chest on everything, and so I think a lot of the best blockers in the league, this was an observation I kind of stumbled on along the way. Like I wanted to know who were the best blockers, and I watched them and studied them intently, and a lot of those guys use their gloves. They pick a lot, you know, the Thomas Nitos of the world, like picks mm-hmm. everything and is one of the best blockers in all of baseball. Jose Trevino, like if it squares him up, he's really efficient at getting the ball to his belly button. But if it's outside his body slightly, you know, he picks it and he does it at a really, really efficient rate, probably more efficient than trying to body something and then have to recover it, get the ball to your hand. I mean, once a ball is picked, like there's no opportunity to advance. I mean, it really kills the base runner's instincts to be able to try to advance on dirt balls. And so it's something you have to train. It's not lazy. It's not because we're in bad positions. It's actually something we're really intentional about. And if nothing else, if given our catchers the freedom to not rely on, but to use as a tool, if or when needed.
Tanner, I love that you're outside right now. I think you have the loudest bird sitting on the picnic bench with you right now. It's awesome. Because receiving is so prevalent, I wanted to do a quick exercise here with you. Without being able to name your own catchers here, give us your top three receiving catchers in the game right now.
The guys in Pittsburgh are killing it. Jason DeLay, Austin Hedges, those two guys are up there. William Contreras is having a really good year. I think he's made a big jump, and they've done a really good job with him in Milwaukee. Those three stand out to me.
Well, I'll jump in and say I have the StatCast leaderboard right in front of me, and those three guys are all in the top eight. And it's a little bit of cheating because you're not allowed to pick your own guys. Jose Trevino, the leader in the major leagues last year, and he's right up there with the leaders again this year.
Yeah, I probably look at those leaderboards too often. So
you guys have your own proprietary metrics too, in terms of even more extensive than we see on StatCast. I know every organization does.
Yeah, we do.
Anything you can tell me, is it count specific or things you prioritize at the position in terms of framing or anything else? When you evaluate a catcher the next day, you know, what are the first things you look at or you prioritize?
So we do have our own system. I'm not sure how much it varies from the public site. It is count specific. You know, the strike zone is a living, breathing thing that changes by the count. So we're not using the standard rule book strike zone. We're actually using very specific umpire, you know, strike zone. What is this particular umpire? What is his zone? And when we have enough historical data to be able to know that, okay, this guy gives this much down, he gives this much in, doesn't give away. And so we actually can form a strike zone for that particular umpire. And then we evaluate our catchers, you know, based on whether we gained or lost strikes within, you know, that environment, you know, with that particular umpire. And there's, we include the pitcher, the batter, you know, they all have reputations. You know, the Brett Gardners of the world would potentially have a smaller strike zone, right? Just because of, you know, they could intimidate umpires, and the Aaron Judges of the world, because of his physique, like, you know, has a larger strike zone. So we can factor in, you know, the hitters, and same thing with pitchers. There's pitchers who can bully umpires, and even though some of that I think is less prominent than maybe it was once was, just because I think umpires are held more accountable to the actual strike zone, as opposed to, you know, giving the veteran player a little bit more rope and squeezing the rookie. And I think there's less of that going on, just because, like I said, these umpires are being graded. They're being evaluated based on the strike zone and how accurate they are within it. So anyway, there's a lot that goes into, you know, our strike probability models that kind of ultimately, you know, spits out a report. And So we look at that with the catchers. We know where they gain and where they lose strikes, and we look for trends in terms of, you know, are there particular parts of the zone we're losing strikes? And then we look at the movement quality. okay, what is the load like in terms of where is the glove height at pitch release, and maybe how quick or how late was the move? You know, how efficient was it in terms of its directness to the pitch, and what was the post catch move direction? You know, was it a more vertical move versus a horizontal move? And we know which of all of those things, you know, are more advantageous or less advantageous for gaining or losing strikes. So it's much more than just the stance, you know, and we're kind of well beyond that part of it, and really digging deeper in terms of the quality of the catch. And we have data and metrics to kind of look at that objectively and compare that to other players throughout the league who really excel at in certain parts of the strike zone. So we're digging pretty deep and trying to uncover every rock and find any edge. The margins have only gotten smaller and smaller with, you know, I think catchers throughout the league are getting really, really good at this skill. So it's becoming harder and harder to separate. So we're trying to stay ahead and, you know, dig and look at as much nuance as possible to try to find an advantage.
Do you feel vindication now at this point, considering all the brushback you got when you first started, especially from old schoolers, and kind of continues a little bit to today, you know, and especially with blocking? And there's still, I hear one on a broadcast every now and then, an old schooler say, hey, he's down on one knee. See that fastball? I mean, you've got the data to back it up now. I mean, you're well established. You see it across the league. Everything's been, you know, the proof's in the pudding, right? I mean, everybody's doing it. They wouldn't be doing it if it didn't work. Do you feel it's okay to take a victory lap, right? Do you feel like, you know?
I really don't, to be honest. Like the criticism is always louder than the praise. So I still listen too often to, you know, and I take it too personal. I'm maybe too immature. But
I think that's natural, man. I think it's absolutely natural for everyone in whatever walk of life they're in.
Yeah. So, to some degree that it's, you know, to see how quickly it's been adopted throughout the league. You know, there's definitely some validation there. And, but at the same time, it's what have you done for me lately? And we're trying to move on and figure out what the next thing is. So no time for a victory lap.
Okay. Now the most important topic, Swanee's Bar in Seattle. I mean, people don't, you know, maybe people need to hear the history with your father and the league. And I certainly spent some time there. Everybody that's come through Seattle over the years certainly has met there at one point in time, you know, met your family, met your pops. You know, there's a lot of history there. I know some of those stories we can't tell, but, you know, it is an interesting kind of family matter there that people might not understand. So what can you tell us about it?
It is kind of a cool story. You know, my dad was a left-handed catcher, so maybe I was like bred for this unconventional path in terms of the catching world. And, you know, he played for this independent professional team out of Portland, the Portland Mavericks. Like I said, he was left-handed. He caught Jim Boughton, and there's a lot of really cool, unique stories from that team. And so he kind of carried that persona to Seattle with him and opened up a bar in the early 80s, and it became kind of a hot spot for players. It was two blocks from the Kingdom. So my whole childhood, I like to say I grew up in a sports bar and sitting at the side table, you know, while my dad worked and when I visited him on the weekend. So, but
everybody went through there. The whole league went through there.
Yeah, and I've heard stories my entire life, you know, about the Coneys and the Goodries, and there was always this thing with the Yankees. To be honest, I don't know what it was. It seemed more so than other clubs, but I always heard Yankee stories. And every time the Yankees were in town, we had tickets and we'd go to the games. And so yeah, it's a fun time. I love reconnecting with guys like Coney and making that connection. And some of the, it's fun to see the face, to see the expression when I make that connection.
Yes.
Yeah. That was my dad's place, and to watch people like Coney get nervous and okay, what does this guy know?
You know where the bodies are buried. That's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So it's been fun.
Tanner, what's the coolest memory you have with a former big leaguer from being in your father's establishment?
This one wasn't personal, but it's definitely a vivid memory, and you know, maybe one I shouldn't share on here. It's not horrible, but I remember my dad ran a promotion for it was for Dave Valley's. They were selling well drinks for Dave Valley's batting average, you know, and this is when he was the catcher in Seattle, and I remember going to the Kingdom, and you know, and they weren't very good at the time, and so there weren't a lot of fans. And he would get out, and the stadium would cheer, you know, that this is their own player. And it caught media buzz, and Dave Valley, I'm sure, was not happy about it. Not a fan of my father. Maybe that's why he's not a fan of knee down setups now. I'm not
he's,
sure.
He's still a critic, isn't he? Yeah.
So I don't know if he's made that connection, and I obviously have nothing personal. I mean, I actually respect Dave a lot for what he's done in the game, but that's a vivid memory. Just you know, that promotion and how it kind of caught media's attention and became a thing that was buzzing in the city.
That's excellent. Excellent stuff. Tanner, thanks so much for taking some time with us here. We love what you're doing with all the catchers behind the plate. Receiving has become the focal point of the position, and under your guidance, the Yankees are doing it better than most here. So we thank you here.
Pick it. Pick thanks. That.
Thanks, Coney.
You got
thanks,
it, Tanner.
Justin. Appreciate you guys. Love take the show. Care. Take care. See you guys.
All right, David, from a player's perspective, give us the description of this establishment in downtown Seattle during your playing days. Was this like a dive bar, a hole in the wall? What did we have going on here?
Probably closer to a hole in the wall, more an old school sports bar, but it was two blocks from the King Dome. So a lot of players around the league, really the American League back then, would go straight from the clubhouse. You'd shower up and, hey, let's go meet at Swanee. So that was the spot. It was, you know, you didn't have to take the team bus if you didn't want to. You could go drown your sorrows. You had a tough game, you'd go right to Swanee's, or if you had a great game, you could go right to Swanee's. But it was a gathering point. I remember hanging out with Dave Henderson there, the late great Dave Hindu. Was a great outfielder for a lot of different teams, including Seattle. He lived in the area, and he was always a guy that would be there, you know, and you could always catch up with Hindu there. It was one of the great characters of all time. So the stories go on and on. You know, Swanee's father, of course, Tanner hanging out there as a kid, as a young man. And certainly that was a big influence in his life, I'm sure, seeing the stories. And, you know, it was really just about war stories, really. You know, it's like a Bruce Springsteen song, right? Glory Days. I mean, that's where we all gathered. We all talked our talk, and it was a safe place. That was the thing that everybody, you know, whenever you get big leaguers hanging out in a place like that, you feel safe. You feel like you can let your hair down. You can talk a little bit, and you know, nobody's going to know, you know, you're going to be protected there. And that was the kind of place it was.
Those are the places that we all wish we had on our list of reliable settings in any city we visit, but mainly in our own neighborhood. People, more Tone the Slab is coming up, but first I need to tell you about how you can hit it out of the park this baseball season with DraftKings Sportsbook. New customers can place a $5 bet and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. Plus, all customers can take a shot at bigger payouts with DraftKings stepped-up same-game parlays. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app, sign up with code SLAB, that's S-L-A-B, and new customers can bet just $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code SLAB. Only at DraftKings Sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In Massachusetts, call 800-327-5050 or visit gamblinghelplinema.org. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. In Kansas, call 1-800-522-4700. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, 21 or plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details and state-specific responsible gaming resources. Bonus bets expire 7 days after issuance. Opt-in and 10-plus leg requirement for 100% boost. Eligibility, wagering, and deposit restrictions apply. Terms at sportsbook.draftkings.com/baseball terms. All right, let's get to some Yankees chat, guys. We talked about Aaron Judge missing some time. Let's dive deeper into the outfield situation here. You know, on one hand, you're like, well, how can they be you know, how can they be as competitive without a guy like Aaron Judge? Obviously a star, their best player. And a lot of people say, well, look what we're left with here. This is an organizational failure on the part of the Yankees. Well, it's tough to say that when you do have 3-4 outfielders on the injured list all at once. It's tough for any organization to make up all those losses. But in the present moment, we are left with guys like Connor Falefa and Bowers and Calhoun, Oswaldo Cabrera, Stanton eventually when he's not just DHing. What can be done in the present moment to improve the Yankees outfield situation?
It all has to be internal at this point. There might be a couple of scrap heap guys that might have minor league options or opt-outs in their minor league deals. There might be a couple of guys worth looking at, you know, but I'm not sure that there's anybody out there that's any better than what they have in AAA, whether it's Franchy Cordero or Estevan Florial. Probably Cordero, he's already on the roster. You could probably call him right back up. It's probably the easiest maneuver right now. But yeah, I think you go back to spring training and you look at the outfield depth. And the Yankees made bets. They made a bet on Jake Bowers and had him in AAA. And he's kind of paid off, really. That was a big, big game he had in LA. His numbers overall are well above average. Going to see more of him. Willie Calhoun has been much better as of late. He's a tough out. He's a pee machine. He hits line drives everywhere, Willie Calhoun does. And so, you know, that's what's going to have to be done internally. And wait for Harrison Bader to get back. That's a big piece as well that could be back within a week or so. But that's it. You're going to score less runs. There's just no two ways about it. Without Aaron Judge in the lineup, you're going to score less runs because he is that good. And that puts the emphasis on defense, on all the little things, on allowing fewer runs, on continuing to pitch well on the Yankee side. And their bullpen has been great up to now. It's going to have to keep on keeping on and win some close games. They lost 1-3-2 last night. They need to be on the other end of those kind of games and win some 3-2s until Judge gets back.
Get Harrison Bader back. I think that's number one on the list. It's a short-term injury. So if you're treading water for a few games, then Bader gets back soon. That's one less thing to worry about. Bowers, you brought it up, Coney, 127 OPS plus, which is 27% better than league average and probably more than anyone could have hoped for. And so that's one thing. If you have one question mark in the outfield, that's not a big deal. But when you have that and then two guys that you were banking on, Judge and Bader, then they go down at the same time, you're going to be up against it. But long term, Aaron Judge, Harrison Bader locked in. Giancarlo Stanton, if whatever he gives you in the outfield is gravy, either that or he's locking down the DH spot, holding it down there. So I think it is just something that you just have to have blow over and get production from other spots.
Yeah, this is just another point of the season where you have to for the river, to borrow an old phrase from Oregon Trail. People of a certain age know what I'm talking about there. But weather the storm, obviously, and like David said, other areas of the team, not specifically just the hitting, need to step it up. Run prevention is underscored in situations like this. And that kind of leads me to maybe my next question for you guys, talking about the pitching, getting back to our bread and butter here with this Yankees starting rotation, now down Nestor Cortez with some shoulder issues. Hopefully it's just some downtime will kind of revamp and re-energize that shoulder. And you take a look at the supporting cast, I guess, behind Gerrit Cole. It's always the big question mark. I see a guy like Clark Schmidt, who was on the mound on Tuesday night, looked pretty good, registered a quality start. Last four appearances, he has a 2.49 earned run average. Are we starting to see a young pitcher in Clark Schmidt maybe turn the corner in the rotation?
I say yes. The quality of his pitches has been measurably better by any metrics you want to use. You know, he's always had he's always been a darling of the analytics community because he possesses such high spin rate, such stuff plus. If you rate his pitches, boy, that they're really the potential, you could see it there. The sharpness of the break on all of his breaking pitches, from his knuckle curve to his cutter to his sweeper. You know, they're all high quality, high spin pitches. So yes, the quality of his pitches have gotten better, and that includes location. So there's a lot of different ways to measure it, whether it's just pure stuff, you know, the movement profile, the command location plus is another stat that you break down pitchers on. All of them across the board have gotten better for Clark Schmidt. He's locating better. His stuff is sharper. It's still, in terms of spin rate and the movement profile, still among the best in the league. So, yes, if you look at his FIP, things he controls, the fielder independent pitching, it's down around the low fours, 4.32, much lower than his ERA. So he's trending in the right direction. He's gaining confidence. He's getting deeper into the games. And that was the worry early was, God, it's a fourth inning. You've got to get a little bit more out of you. And now we are. Now he's getting through six innings. Now he's a threat to get deeper into the games. That to me is the biggest improvement, that his own confidence on the mounds allowing him to get deeper in the games and trust his stuff much more.
When the ERA is at 6.30, it's going to take a while to get that down. So don't look at the season numbers for a little while, but he is getting better every start. And even the loss to the White Sox, 3 runs in 6 innings. One was a short porch home run. One was a long home run, but well enough to win the game. If the Yankees offense does anything, if they get a hit for him, then it becomes, oh, wow, he really kept him in the game. He's been fantastic. The cutter has been better. That was such a problem pitch. It looked good in spring training, and then it just didn't translate in the first part of the season. But during this 4-start stretch with the 2.5 ERA, batters 4-for-24 against the cutter. Everything's getting better. It's a long process, but Schmidt has looked a lot better, and they need it because with Nestor Cortez going down, that's a spot in the rotation that they need.
You know, one indicator that the pitch quality is there, like we said, you know, with Schmidt, the raw stuff has always been there. The pitch quality, the pitch selection, he's going deeper and he's being efficient along the way. Last night against the White Sox, he only needed 79 pitches to get through 6 innings. So good signs from Clark Schmidt. We'll see if he can keep it up here, but definitely encouraging signs for a rotation that needs some at the moment. And we'll see what happens down the road here. All right, guys, that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Courtney, where are you at this Sunday night?
Oh, right here. Red Sox Yankees going to be the back-to-back Sundays. We're going to be in New York, obviously, for the Red Sox Sunday night, and then the following weekend in Boston. So back-to-back. You know, ESPN, they with the balanced schedule, they're going to grab every Red Sox Yankees game they can, right? So even if it's back-to-back weekends, we're going to see the old rivalry spark back up.
That's right. They're coming out at the premium here in 2023. So you get back-to-back weeks of Yankees Red Sox on Sunday Night Baseball. 3 straight weeks for the Yankees on Sunday Night Baseball. So you know what that means? You get 3 straight off days the following day on a Monday. So we all like that. All right, guys, that's going to do it for this episode. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel so you do not miss a single thing of what we are streaming each and every week. For David Cohn, for James Smythe, for our outstanding producer, Dan Work, this is Justin Shackle. Big thank you to Yankees catching coach Tanner Swanson for joining us this week. We will talk to you next week on Tone of the Slab, Pitching with David Cohn, a production of John Boy Media. Take care.